stronger. Let me give you another example, Jason, of a individual who bore a name that is essential to understanding their mission. Moshe was given the name Moshe, which means to draw out, from the Hebrew verb meaning to draw out, because the purpose of the Torah is to lead us away from human institutions, particularly those represented by Mitzrayim, the crucibles of human oppression, away from religious, political, military, and economic malfeasance of man. And so we're being drawn out of those things and towards the promised land, which is to live in Yahweh's home. That's why the man who scribed the Torah for us, name means to draw out. The Torah is guidance to draw us out of that. Now, another individual who was not named by a Hebrew, who probably didn't even know Hebrew at the time that he was named, and his parents would have named him, and his parents were Babylonian, and that is Abram, who became Abraham. Abram is combined with the Hebrew word father, Abba, and then it starts with enriching father, and to that Yahweh adds racham, which is the Hebrew word for mercy. And so it becomes enriching and merciful father. The purpose of Abraham is to show us the role that Yahweh plays in conceiving his covenant, and the purpose of his family, in that he had a child named Laughter, Yisak. And so here's the person who was given a name by a Babylonian, but yet it was a name that served Yahweh's intent perfectly. So, Jason, my view of that is that when it is in our interest for Yahweh to engage in human affairs, he does. And he can engage with somebody that doesn't know him. You know, he can say, yeah, I think you ought to name this boy Abram. I think you ought to name this child Moshe. And it happens. Yahweh tells us that he used Cyrus. Cyrus was a egocentric, conniving pagan. Cyrus never knew Yahweh. Yahweh used him. He can, so Yahweh can even use those who don't know him. That
I was just thinking. I like the idea of confirming the meanings given in lexicons with the pictorial, like the images, because I just suspected at times, you know, looking at, say, a word like Sodom or something, and you see, you know, like desolation and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when they were kind of restoring the Hebrew language, they kind of put the cart before the horse kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to have the pictorial confirmation there. And then
it's too bad, because what you're right, what happened is that as they tried to restore Hebrew, which was essentially a dead language at the time that Israel was founded in 1948, and the problem was that people came back to Israel from all over the world, and they spoke all different languages, and so the only way they could really have a country and communicate was to have a common language, and they took written Hebrew, and they did their best to create to revive ancient Hebrew, and they got some things right and some things wrong in that process. But one of the things they got wrong was they took the script, the alphabet that had been used in Babylon. And they used that alphabet as opposed to going to the original pictograph alphabet.
What does that say?
Yeah.
And I like when you get those hints in the Torah too, where it says, you know, he was named this because of this.
Right.
That really kind of sets it more firmly in stone, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, or for example, if it says he was named Moshe because he was drawn out of the reeds. And so the next and drawn out of the Nile, if you will, and then you look at, well, since boy, Moshe is based on this verb to draw out that Yahweh just mentioned. So I'm being told that the name is defined by that verb. Yahweh introduces Torah by saying that it provides his Yara, his teaching, his guidance, the source from which his instruction flows. And so, you know, if he's going to define an important noun or name with a verb, it's pretty good chance that he is giving you some insights you ought to pay attention to. For example, Yahweh. You know, we began this with Yahweh. Doesn't he introduce his name by telling us the verb upon which it's based?
Mm-hmm. Hiya.
I was, I am, I will be. I exist.
The interesting thing is, you would, when you have, you know, like other people name mm-hmm. People like Moses and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting fact is you would think that you would see the legacy of Hebrew and every other language because it takes precedence over all of them.
Yes. And there are many hundreds of English loanwords from Hebrew. And there are Greek and Latin loanwords from Hebrew. Hebrew words permeate our vocabulary. So no, they are all over the place. And when you look at the Hebrew and then you consider the English, you say, that one made it. And so, you know, there are a lot of loan words. But even though that is the case, you would especially expect it to be prevalent because of the commonality between Hebrew and Aramaic. They're really similar. And Aramaic was, while Hebrew is the language of God, Aramaic was the language of man during the time of man's most far-reaching and game-changing civilization. The Babylons had a greater influence on how civilized man would live together from a religious, political, military, and economic perspective than did any other culture. And their language, Aramaic, very, very similar to Hebrew. The words are pronounced almost identically.
So how old is Aramaic?
Aramaic as a spoken language is probably of similar age to Hebrew, but at the time that Hebrew was developed, it developed an alphabet to convey what the words meant in writing. Aramaic was using the Sanskrit. It was a not quite cuneiform, but you know, it was a series of lines that were forms as vertical horizontal lines or as triangles pointing in one direction or another, and so they weren't designed to convey sounds like an alphabet, but they were designed primarily because the early version of Aramaic conveyed through the Sanskrit alphabet was conceived to facilitate the single most important thing in creating a civilization. Do you know what that was? What was the very basis of being able to create the first civilization, and why the alphabet, if you will, the Sanskrit's really not an alphabet, but it is used to convey the words in writing of Aramaic. Do you know what it was conceived to accomplish?
The communication and commerce.
It is communication in one very specific aspect of commerce. Making a beer.
Oh, making beer, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So growing the hops for beer, growing the most beer there was usually barley at the time, but you can use a number of other grains in beer. The growing of the hops, culturing of the yeast, growing of the grain, and then the transportation of and the brewing of and payment of beer was a currency. You know, like the Egyptians that built the pyramids, they were paid in the currency of the day, which was beer. And without beer, civilization doesn't exist, because when you get a lot of people together, you pollute the water with their trash and their discharge of bodily fluids, if you will. And so you have to have the water purified. And at that time, they had no idea that boiling would accomplish it. But the whole process of brewing and the creation of alcohol killed the pathogens, and it made it possible for civilizations, for people to live in close proximity to one another without being nomadic. Otherwise, they just had to move all over the place to have a water supply that would kill them. So
I've been fascinated at times with some of Ron Wyatt's legacy. I remember looking at when he found the Ark.
Noah. Yes. Right.
He found some sort of stones or something that had just X's in them.
Right.
And he was under the impression that they had to do with marking the family tree or something, the family line.
Yes. Yeah, there was actually one that had pictures of the eight people that got off of the Ark as men and women, and of the eight of them that got off of the Ark, and kind of, and then X's as to a family tree thereafter.
Oh, I didn't know there was pictures as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, I was listening recently to one of the last recordings of him, and he was describing finding the Ark of the Covenant. Do you think?
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, the let's just deal with the Noah's Ark for those who are not knowledgeable about Ron Wyatt. Ron Wyatt was a really devout Christian. I suspect at the very end of his life, his Christianity was being called into question because of what he was finding. Because his entire focus was finding in the desert sands of Israel or Saudi Arabia, or in this case, in eastern Turkey, the very things that Yahweh talked about. So that he said, you know, God said these were real. They occurred in this place. I would like to demonstrate that the story is not mythological, but truthful and actual by finding these things. And so he focused on them, and he found a number of them. We'll talk about those when we return. So what this man who... I did not know. He died shortly before I began this journey of discovery. I did meet his widow. I had many long talks with, a very long talk with her, I should say. I was given the full cadre of everything that he wrote and recorded, and have listened and read it all. And I have been to his museum, and I have physically examined the evidence that he brought back. And to your comment, Jason, I am absolutely certain that he found Noah's Ark. Absolutely certain. And not only am I certain he found Noah's Ark based upon his depictions of it and some of the fascinating things he did, metallurgy studies, and found that there was titanium in some of the rivets. He analyzed the pitch, analyzed the dimensions, analyzed the fact that they were glue lamps. You know, there was no way that Noah ever could have built an ark where he could have managed to carry beams that would have been the necessary size to support those decks and to support the infrastructure. Would have been impossible. But if he's bringing 20 trees to create one beam, and he's creating a glue lamb. Glue lamb is much stronger than a single piece of wood, and yet it's easy to build in place. And he found the evidence of glue lamps. But beyond that, I just did something really simple. Turkish government realized that he found the Ark too. And they made a park out of the Ark, sealed it off. It's in eastern Turkey. Nobody can get to it today. But one thing you can do today, You can use Google Earth for any place on the earth. You want to see the ark? Use Google Earth. You can look right at it. And it's right where he said he was going to be. I even enjoy it. Him telling me how he came to that location, because he realized that what the Hebrews said is wasn't on Mount Ararat. It was near the mountains of Ararat. And so what he did is that he created a model of the mountains, the chain of Ararat, and he created a model, and he flooded it with water. And he put an ark of the right size and dimensions in the midst of this, you don't really call them dioramas, but of this model that he made. And then he gradually let the water dissipate. And what he found is that the way the tendencies of water as it comes off the slopes of a mountain is that the ark could never have landed on Mount Ararat if it had started directly above Ararat. And that's the single mountain, but at the mountain chain, he found exactly where it would have ended up based on the flow, outflow of water, and that's where he went. And guess what he found? The ark right there.
Yes.
So process of thinking.
In your travels, learn any more about the... he said there was a point where he was with Malak in the
starting the Ark of the Covenant,
and he removed the tablets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any information about the tablets, or did he get any sort of?
His wife talked to me at length about it, and his wife said is that this is something that her husband was allowed to see just before his passing. He spent his entire life on this quest. And he was not actually looking for the Ark of the Covenant when he came upon it. I think he was really more looking for other things. But he was in the logical place. He was right beneath the empty tomb. Right at the current peak of Mount Moriah, because they took Mount Moriah had kind of two peaks, and they took one of them and became the Temple Mount. The other still is there, and it's where the garden or the empty tomb is. And it's what he came to realize is the same thing that I came to realize when I was in Israel. The back of the Jerusalem bus station actually is the encampment behind it. You can still see the image of a skull carved into the limestone rock face. That is the image of the skull, and it was directly below the empty tomb on Mount Moriah, just outside the Damascus Gate, is where the receptacle was for the upright pole, for a Passover. And he found that there was an entrance next to where the tomb is that would take you down into what is known as Yirmiyah's grotto. And as he made his way there, he found first the very receptacle and the crack in the earth of the earthquake fault that the pole was in. Kirk, we've lost Jason, but sorry with you. I'd kind of like to just to talk a little bit more about what was found. What he recognized is that as he was in these underground passageways, he came to a spot that had it's an 8-inch deep by about 8-inch in both directions, receptacle that was carved into the limestone that used to be at street level. You know how when civilizations fall, people build on top of things, and of course the levels, if you want to go back in time, you dig down to go into levels. And so we found the level. We're right in front of the cliff, which has got Golgotha, the sign of the skull. It's got this skull still there and still visible. He found the receptacle. And not only did he find the receptacle cut 8 by 8 by 8, which tells you that the way that they reused the upright pole and held the upright pole in place. He found where the earth had cracked. You know, we're told there was an earthquake and the earth cracked there.
Mm-hmm.
And he found right there that the earth had cracked. And he says, oh, could it be? It just dawned on him. Could it be? Could the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant be directly below this so that when the blood of the sacrificial lamb, Yahshua, was shed on this spot, that it was his blood that anointed the mercy seat in accordance with the Torah's instructions on the mercy seat? Could that be where it is? If that's where it is, wow, we have the ultimate fulfillment of the Torah right before our eyes.
And it has to be.
And it had to be. And the moment he came to that and shared that realization, and his wife sharing it with me, I said, oh my. Oh, it has to be. And sure enough, he was able to clear some rubble out of the way and to go down through another passageway, and he got directly below it. And when he entered an area where he was able to stand and walk, and was a large area of what would look like as a cistern today, would be to hold water.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the Ark of the Covenant. And there was that blood right there in the mercy seat. And there was a malach. One of Yahweh's spiritual envoys. And the malach said, no, I'm just doing my job here. The first thing he says, well, you know, this can't be any fun. What in the hell are you doing underground here? He says, I've been assigned the Ark of the Covenant. This is my job to watch over it. He says, well, how long are you going to do that? He says, well, there will be a day that I am going to hold up these two tablets. And he lifted the two tablets.
Wow.
Says, these are the original two tablets that Yahweh etched in stone. My job on a very specific day, and now time doesn't matter to him. So, you know, we're looking at this as, oh my God, you know, he's been here all that time, 2,000 years. And
snap your finger and that's 2,000 years.
Right. So he says, there is a specific time that I've been asked to show these tablets so they can be seen by the whole world. And I'm going to take them up and I'm going to show the whole world. And he says, my job is to show the world what Yahweh wrote in stone so that all of the corruptions that are being promoted at that time are dispelled. So that people who are open to the truth will know the truth and they will know the lie will be exposed. I am been asked to do that and I'm going to do that. And he says, can I show people these? Is it possible to take the Ark of the Covenant out of here? He said, no, I'd have to kill you. I'm sorry. No, the Ark of the Covenant is not going to move.
Yeah, I got to kill you.
You know, it's staying right here. My job is to protect the Ark of the Covenant. You've obviously been allowed to see it, and here you go. You know, here it is. And he says, can I take a picture of it? Sure, it's not going to come out. But, you know, it's like taking a picture of the sun. You know, you're going to take a picture of light. And what came out is light. Because the malach is light. And he says, okay. So he got his picture, and it's just light. And he said, can I come back? No.
Oh, that's good.
Welcome to stay as long as you want. We can chit-chat here, but
that's good.
No. Then he did, he was, according to his wife, he was able to take a small sample of the blood that was on the mercy seat. He wanted to test it. And his wife said that the sample of blood was unlike anything that anyone had ever encountered before. But he says, you know, what I'm going to tell you about it, he does not want promoted. Way too much controversy, and that anybody that's been associated with that, with what she said and has promoted it has been killed. And then she said,
really?
I want to tell you the story also about the man that Ron Wyatt talked to immediately after the discovery, that decided that he would go in and actually reveal the Ark of the Covenant and, you know, make a name for himself with the greatest archaeological find in human history. He didn't even live to get through the first layer. So I made it real clear that if you want to accept this as being true because it's exactly how Yahweh would do it, then you're entitled to do that. I do. I accept it as being true because it just is exactly what I would have expected of God. But I don't know it to be other than it's just consistent with the way that he does things. It is the one thing, Kirk, that does, other than, can you help me understand what this word means or how to properly translate it or why you said this? It's the one request that I made. I haven't made it in years, but it's the one thing that I would most like. I would like to be able to take a digital camera into that room and to photograph the original autograph of the Torah. Because while Ron did not talk about the Torah being there, because he was fixated on the two tablets and fixated on the Ark of the Covenant and on the Malach, my fixation would have been on the
scroll.
On the scroll. Because what did Yahweh say? He says, you were to always keep the scroll of the Torah beside the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Did he not see the scroll as well?
She didn't mention it. And I was too... this goes back now writing of Tea with Terrors. I mean, this goes back.
Wow, you're way back.
Yeah. Oh, this goes back to 2001. Hmm. I knew at that time 1/1,000,000th of what I know now.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't wise enough to ask these questions. I would love to do so, and it would be. And maybe that was good because his wife is still a Christian. I mean, his comments, Ron Wyatt's comments were, oh boy, when I found this, I realized that there was a ongoing and everlasting connection between the Torah and Yosha, and that there was no change. This was a direct fulfillment of the Torah, a direct enactment of the Torah. And I think that was difficult for him, and it was difficult for his wife. And should I have pushed it, I think it would have made her uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Now, that wasn't the only thing that he found, by the way. He found the crossing from Nuiva Beach on the Gulf of Aqaba of the Red Sea. Found the column that Solomon had put there with Yahweh's name on it, commemorating the crossing. He found the place where the water had gushed out of the rock that Moshe struck as opposed to spoke to. Found the place where the golden calf had been erected. Found the burnt top of Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, in Arabia there. And you can
Google that.
Affirm this too. Google Earth will take you right to it. And so he found all of those things. He found and brought back the brimstone that is still surrounding Sodom on the Dead Sea. I was able to burn some of it. It's amazing the heat to which the stone burns. This is a man that was given the opportunity to and pursued the testimony of Yahweh as if it were absolute historical truth, and every time that he went off on a voyage of discovery, he found more affirmation.
Well, anytime somebody approaches it that way, they generally do, whether they're all the archaeology is found that way, as well as there was a documentary, covering the same thing that said that they knew where it was inside the under the mountain there. That I saw one time, and there's a bunch of rabbis from way back there recorded, or a priest, and they went off the premise that Solomon had used his, there's a reference to Solomon using Egyptian experts to help build the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were very good about using leverages and land to pull things down. And so they assumed that he had that built in there, and you could move the Ark of the Covenant when in danger. They could move it down and move it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the passageways into that grotto goes directly below where the temple was at the Temple Mount.
See, that makes total sense. And yeah. Let me ask you a question. The Ark of the Covenant.
And the purpose of that was, Yahweh says, you know, you want to steal the lead that's inside the stones of this and use that to build your Colosseum?
Yeah.
You know, far away. Go ahead. You want to take some of the accoutrements of the temple, which were symbolic, and haul them off to Babylon?
Yeah.
Go ahead. The Ark of the Covenant, my mercy seat. The place where my scrolls were etched with my finger in stone, the original autograph of the Torah, you think you're going to haul that away and make a mockery of it? Not on your life.
Well, I mean, remember, it was taken one time, and they had to return it because it was knocking over all their little gods.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't mess with this thing.
No, you don't mess. You really do not mess with the Ark of the Covenant. So that would be the thing that I would most like to do, to be able to go there, to photograph it, to translate it, to be able to study it in the original autograph, in the original writing form, and to publish it all on online, but
for another time.
That's one of the things that you don't go because you want to do it.
Yeah.
The only way you'd ever go on that kind of a mission is you'd have to hear Dad saying, "All right, there, kid.
Here's a job.
Step up. I got a job for you. I think, yeah." Or he's going to say, "You know, I think I want somebody else to step up and do that job." But you know, he's going to do what he wants done as it relates to the Ark and the original autograph of the Torah. Kirk, one of the things that I recalled about this initial conversation with Ron Wyatt's widow, and then the subsequent videos that I watched where Ron was talking about these things, I don't even think they sell those videos anymore because of the controversy associated with the Ark of the Covenant find and with how much harassment Ron received during his life about his claims relative to the Nuiva Beach Red Sea crossing during the Exodus, as well as the Ark of the Noah's Ark. Most of the things aren't even available anymore. But I remember just how profoundly it influenced me, even 15 years ago, when, you know, I was just at the infancy of this study.
Mm-hmm.
And I think nothing influenced me more. Finding the Ark of the Covenant I just found fascinating because of the glue lamps and the metallurgy that was used to make the rivets. I just thought that was fascinating, and I thought that the hydraulic study that he did to find the Ark as water would leave the mountains, I found that fascinating. And I found it fascinating, therefore, it could locate Eden as a result. And so I thought all that was interesting. And I thought that all of the information about Nuiva Beach and the crossing and the Exodus was fascinating, but it was the Ark of the Covenant and where it is. And even though that's the thing that he has no proof that he can show you.
Mm-hmm.
It's so strongly resonates. This is exactly what Yahweh would do. This is just so consistent with what he said and who he is and how he works that it was, even 15 years ago, hit me between the eyes. And I'm not sure there's anything that I have learned outside of his Torah.
Mm-hmm.
That has, and this is completely, you know, hearsay. You know, this is a man's widow telling me what a man saw without any evidence.
Yeah.
It's profound for me.
Well, the Christian alternative is that Yahusha would have to have taken a little vial of his blood and presented it in heaven. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well, no, because they think that whole Torah thing was just a waste of time.
Yeah. Yeah,
but how is he going to fulfill the Torah perfectly for us if his blood didn't go in the mercy seat?
Yeah, that's right. But, I mean, I've heard sermons like that, and I'm saying, what?
Right. And when they say, well, it was symbolic. Well, if that was symbolic, then why did the crucifixion, why couldn't that have been symbolic?
Yeah,
why go through it all?
He died. Yeah, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, but it has to go on the mercy seat, and they sprinkled it on the mercy seat over and over for thousands of years.
Right.
In order to present this story, it's going to happen. So it had to happen,
right.
And it's there. So, I mean, that's totally consistent with everything that the Torah says.
Correct.
And he's not going to show it to you until the end, when it's the most critical, just to prove, I told you.
Or you can see it. I've seen it in my mind's eye.
Yeah.
You can see it now because you can see everything that Yahweh has shared with us through his words and his testimony.
And there's
so I can see it right now.
Yeah, there's plenty of evidence right now for us to do what we're doing and become
right.
part of the family. We have more than Abraham had ever had.
Right. Correct. Yeah.
Vastly
more than Moshe had.
Vastly more than Moshe had. We've had Yahusha.
Vastly, vastly more than Matanyah or Yahu Kanan, the disciples had. Vastly
right.
more than Dod had.
Right.
We live in a very privileged time in terms of our access. We have no excuse, and we have every opportunity.
And the fact that's so exciting to me is, and I know that I'm maybe a little redundant, but he brought it up, Jason brought it up about the letters being so satisfying because they tell things. I mean, you can dig this stuff out and prove to yourself that these words, this is the right translation.
Correct.
These are thousands of years old words, letters, and this is what
right.
they mean, and no one has ever contradicted that's what they mean.
Yeah, I would say what's interesting, Kirk, is that I'm not sure the letters provide the best possible translation.
But they confirm a lot of the stuff that's in the translation when you put them together to make a word.
There you go. What the letters do is they affirm the interpretation of the words. The definitions of the words are more than sufficient. You know, if you look up the Hebrew words and particularly pay attention to the verbal root, the actionable aspect of that word, you can absolutely come to know what God said.
Right.
But then when you put it all together and you form the picture of a father inviting us to participate in his family, it's then the letters that affirm that interpretation, that understanding, is precisely what he is conveying to us.
Yeah, it just reaffirms everything, and that's the comfort to me.
Yep. Let's do the 23rd Psalm tonight.